It is Thursday, April 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. Coming up, the race for the White House after Tuesday's primaries. A multi-billion dollar drug company merger falls through. Amnesty International says the number of executions last year rose by nearly 50%. And we'll hear about the life and times of the late Merle Haggard. That's all on today's International Edition. Thousands of people crammed into a Long Island soundstage Wednesday to hear Republican frontrunner Donald Trump speak in his first speech since losing Tuesday's Wisconsin primary to Texas Senator Ted Cruz. Trump did not mention his loss, but stayed on his message of making America great again. Speaking in Bethpage, Long Island, the Republican candidate said that he would penalize American companies for moving their businesses to other countries.
We're going to bring back our country. We're going to make our country strong again. We're going to make our country respected again. We're going to use our finest people. We're going to use our brightest minds. We're going to make great deals, great transactions. We're going to have Apple Computer, and we're going to have companies like that, many, many companies. They're going to start making their product not in China, but in the USA, folks. That's where they're going to make their product. 100%. 100%.
Meanwhile, Ted Cruz visited a restaurant in the Bronx where he was met by some shouting protesters who eventually had to be removed by police. Cruz said that he was excited about the momentum he picked up after his primary win in Wisconsin.
I'm thrilled to be back in New York, thrilled to be here at a small business. We just had a tremendous meeting with pastors here in the Bronx, with Hispanic pastors, with African-American pastors. And I'm so encouraged after what was a terrific victory yesterday in Wisconsin. It was a turning point, I believe, in this entire election. It culminated four states in a row in the last 2 weeks where we have beaten Donald Trump over and over and over again.
Meanwhile, Democratic Party frontrunner Hillary Clinton was campaigning in Pennsylvania. She said that her opponent Bernie Sanders doesn't seem to have the ability to get things done.
But Senator Sanders and I have some real differences about how we would go about achieving our goals as president. And like a lot of people, I am concerned that some of his ideas just won't work because the numbers don't add up. Others won't even pass Congress, or they rely on Republican governors suddenly having a conversion experience and becoming progressives. Well, in a number of important areas, he doesn't have a plan at all.
Mrs. Clinton and the Democrats have a caucus Saturday in Wyoming. The next Republican nominating contest is April 19th in New York. Be sure to stay tuned to VOA for full coverage of election 2016, right up through the presidential inauguration next January. Donald Trump mentioned in his speech about keeping American companies in the United States, but it was an Obama administration policy that eventually killed a multi-billion dollar deal on Wednesday. The New York-based drug company Pfizer and Irish-based Allergan decided to kill a $160 billion deal that would have let Pfizer move its operations to Ireland and avoid U.S. taxes. Pfizer cited new U.S. Treasury rules, which would make so-called tax inversions less lucrative. Under the deal, Pfizer would have moved its address, but not its operations, to Ireland and would have paid fewer dollars in corporate taxes. From New York, business correspondent Jill Malandrino spoke with my colleague Jim Stevenson about the deal and how it could be the beginning of several similar collapses after revelations in the so-called Panama Papers.
This was a big deal. This was a $160 billion deal that fell apart because of the Treasury Department's move. And as a result, Allergan shares got hammered by 20%. That's a huge blow to shareholders. Now, it has recovered off of the lows. I think it hit around $215 per share. We're somewhere in the $240 range right now. But that is a tremendous blow when you have the expectation that the deal is going to go through and it's pulled as quickly as the Treasury Department steps in. And, you know, the argument here is, and I'm torn with it in a couple respects, but agree with it for the most part. Why shouldn't wealthy taxpayers and corporations shoulder their tax responsibilities for the average American like you and I? Do you understand it from the corporation's perspective that the U.S. tax code is the most complex in the world? And from a business perspective, I could see why they want to do offshore business or go to more tax-friendly countries. But at the end of the day, these companies are making so much money, record revenue, they should foot their part of the bill as well.
It doesn't take much to make investors nervous, and this is going to be going on for much of the year as we get more revelations out of the Panama Papers.
Oh, yeah, this just isn't extended to Panama. So you have to think of other offshore legal and banking centers around the world that have exposure here. You have London, you have the Isle of Man, you have Cyprus, Cayman, and Belize is some examples. Also, we're going into earnings season next week. Alcoa kicks off the unofficial start to earnings. And, you know, right now, according to analysts at S&P, they only expect 3 of 10 S&P 500 sectors to beat earnings expectations. Clearly, energy is going to be one dark spot in earnings. But even if you take out energy earnings, analysts expect Q1 earnings to be negative 3.6%. So earnings expectations are low going into the quarter starting next week. You have global growth slowing down. You have the Brexit vote in June where the UK may decide to exit the European Union. You have the elections in November. And now you throw more uncertainty on top of that pile. Even though the markets have been in a consistent uptrend, you might want to exercise a little bit of caution as well. And right now, we've had such a significant run that some corrective action could be a good thing so we can get some new money into the market. But there is a lot on investors' plates right now as we move into the next earnings season and approach the summer.
That's business reporter Jill Malandrino in New York. Pfizer is the maker of the anti-cholesterol drug Lipitor, the antibiotic Zithromax, the neuropathic pain reliever Lyrica, and, of course, Viagra, which is for erectile dysfunction in men. The failure of the Allergan-Pfizer merger was one of the top trending stories on social media Wednesday. For more, we turn to our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee. Hello, G.
Hi, David.
What's the big story for today?
Like you mentioned earlier, it's about Pfizer, one of the largest pharmaceutical companies in the world. The American company confirmed the termination of its merger with Dublin-based Allergan, and that merger was supposed to be worth $160 billion. Instead, Pfizer will pay Allergan $400 million to break away from the agreement and also to not be subject to new tax regulations.
So what's the response been like online?
NPR's Facebook post had the most interesting responses, and this is the most liked reply so far. Let us all have a moment of solemn silence to reflect on Pfizer's fate. Consigned to paying taxes where they're actually headquartered and incorporated, we should all weep for poor Pfizer and its multi-billion dollar income not being able to escape basic obligations. That sarcastic reply got more than 1,000 likes. Another person wrote, the U.S. shouldn't be contributing incentives to U.S. companies merging with foreign companies, thereby avoiding taxes and oversight and decreasing U.S. employment. Thank you, President Obama.
So the overall sentiment seems to be in support of the Treasury Department's decision.
That's right.
What else is trending now?
The next trending topic is also relevant to healthcare. An independent regulator in the U.K. ruled Italian fashion brand Gucci's latest ad features a female model that looks too thin. The Advertising Standards Authority of Britain said the luxury brand's ad makes a female's waist look very small and her face gaunt. It went on to say such advertisement is irresponsible. Now, on this side of the pond, a woman confronting Florida Governor Rick Scott at a Starbucks was caught on camera and making the rounds on the internet. Have you seen it yet?
No, I have not.
Well, she was criticizing him for cutting healthcare services, and the clip is about 50 seconds long, and he's making all kinds of faces and small comments while the woman is yelling at him and calling him names. So it's not really a good look for anyone, really. David?
That is social media reporter G. Abby Lee. She tweets on behalf of our show. That's at VOA underscore IE. You can also follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. Coming up, we'll look at U.S. efforts to counter violent extremism and how American Muslims can help. Amnesty International says death penalties increased in 2015. Diabetes is on the rise. And a country superstar dies at age 79. This is VOA.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America. News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington. U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security Jay Johnson has called for cooperation from the American Muslim community during a speech at a symposium on countering violent extremism Wednesday. As VOA's Catherine Gibson reports, Johnson called for more understanding and less heated rhetoric.
The terrorist attack in Brussels last month has renewed debate over ways to counter violent extremism in the United States, with calls by some Republican presidential candidates for surveillance of American Muslim neighborhoods. But Homeland Security head Jay Johnson says that proposal does not reflect reality.
There is no one neighborhood or ghetto or city that one could encircle or surveil American Muslims, contrary to some of the political rhetoric that is out there, some of the overheated political rhetoric out there.
Well, last year's mass shooting in San Bernardino, California, renewed concerns about the threat of homegrown terrorism. Johnson said Homeland Security's efforts to prevent more attacks have largely met with cooperation in the American Muslim community.
The overwhelming majority of American Muslims, including those who serve in our United States military, by the way, and in our U.S. government, are patriotic, dedicated people who love this country and who want to help us with public safety and secure our homeland because they know it's their homeland, too.
Johnson also dismissed criticism that Homeland Security's counterterrorism efforts target American Muslims.
The Islamic State, which is the most visible, most prominent, and probably the most dangerous terrorist organization that we face right now, is targeting American Muslims. So we must respond and counter to that effort as a matter of Homeland Security.
Johnson ended his speech with a call for cooperation and bridge building, saying American Muslim communities should not be isolated or vilified. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
Amnesty International says that there was a disturbing rise in the number of executions carried out worldwide in 2015. At least 1,634 people were executed last year. That's a rise of more than 50% and the highest in 25 years. But as Henry Ridgewell reports from London, the true figure is likely much higher.
25 countries carried out the death penalty, but just three, Iran, Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, accounted for 90% of the total. In Pakistan, the December 2014 Taliban attack in Peshawar killed 141 people and led to the government ending its moratorium on executions. Chiara San Giorgio of Amnesty says use of the death penalty increased sharply.
Initially, the moratorium was meant to be lifted only for terrorist-related crimes, but very soon we saw persons being sent to the gallows for murder or other ordinary crimes, often, again, on the basis of trials that really leave a lot of doubts about the safety of the convictions.
At least 158 people were executed in Saudi Arabia, among them the Shiite cleric Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, whose death heightened tensions between Sunnis and Shiites across the region. Riyadh says it uses the death penalty against terrorists, but Amnesty claims it is often used against political dissidents. In Iran, many executions were carried out for drug-related offences. Again, Chiara San Giorgio of Amnesty.
A significant non-proportion of the 977 executions that we recorded for Iran were carried out for drug-related offences, even if international law clearly says that the use of the death penalty should be restricted to intentional killing.
The true number of people executed globally is likely to be much higher because China is excluded from Amnesty's data.
This figure does not include the thousands of people that we believe were executed in China last year, where the use of the death penalty and the figures in particular in relation to the use of the death penalty remain classified as a state secret.
The United States was fifth on the list of the most executions carried out in 2015.
We recorded the lowest number of executions since 1991 and also the lowest number of the sentences imposed since the death penalty was reintroduced in the United States in 1977.
Only six U.S. states carried out executions last year, with Texas accounting for almost half the total. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
The World Health Organization reports that 422 million adults are living with diabetes. As Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the WHO's global report on the disease, the numbers are a fourfold increase over 1980 figures.
The release of this report in advance of World Health Day is meant as a call to global action to halt the rise of type 2 diabetes, which is killing 1.5 million people a year. The World Health Organization estimates 43% of these deaths occur prematurely before the age of 70. The UN agency says diabetes is no longer a disease of the wealthy. Most cases now are found in middle and low-income countries. The WHO says the highest rates are in the Middle East, Southeast Asia, and the Western Pacific. The WHO report says the dramatic rise of this deadly disease is largely due to the increasing number of overweight and obese people. It reports more than 1 in 3 adults is overweight and more than 1 in 10 is obese. Etienne Krug is the director of WHO's Department for Management of Noncommunicable Diseases. He says diabetics will suffer complications from the disease if it is not detected in a timely manner and treated.
People with diabetes have a 2 to 3 times higher risk of cardiovascular disease. They have a 10 to 20 times higher risk of lower limb amputation. Diabetes is an important cause of blindness through diabetic retinopathy and an important cause of end-stage renal disease.
Krug tells VOA the economic cost of diabetes can be catastrophic for both the individual and society. He notes that monthly insulin treatment, which is a question of life and death for many patients, can be expensive.
We know that just the annual direct medical costs exceed $827 billion every year. So it's a very, very vast, large number. And that is not taking into account many other types of costs, such as lost productivity, etc., etc.
The UN agency says adopting a healthy lifestyle can prevent the majority of cases. The report's recommendations include eating healthier, engaging in more physical activity, and avoiding excessive weight gain. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Coming up, we say goodbye to a country music legend. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
From Pink to Pitbull, Beyonce to Bruno Mars, the hits live here on the Top 20 Countdown. Hi, I'm Ray McDonald, and for the past 30 years, I've been counting down the very best of the Billboard Hot 100 Pop Singles Chart. The hit list never sleeps, so don't you miss a moment of the action. Join me every Thursday for the Top 20 Countdown, right here and worldwide on the Voice of America.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
I turned 21 in prison, doing life without parole. No one could steer me right, but Mama tried.
Country music lost one of its icons on Wednesday when singer, songwriter, and musician Merle Haggard died at his home in California. Haggard died on his 79th birthday from complications from pneumonia. I spoke with Jay Orr of the Country Music Hall of Fame in Nashville, Tennessee, about the life and influence of Merle Haggard.
Merle was one of the greats of country music. It's hard to sum up his achievement in the field, but he was a songwriter. He was a performer. He was a musician. He stood shoulder to shoulder with the people we think of as the greats of the genre, people like Hank Williams, Willie Nelson, Kris Kristofferson, and Johnny Cash. But he really embodied the country music singer-songwriter. In the museum here, the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum, we have what we call our core exhibit that tells the story of country music. And we've called the core exhibit Sing Me Back Home, A Journey Through Country Music. Of course, Sing Me Back Home is a Merle Haggard song. He connects with the story that we tell in a great and important way.
Now, he was a very versatile songwriter. He could write about songs about broken hearts, like I Think About Silver Wings or Today I Started Loving You Again. He also did some stuff that was autobiographical, things like Mama Tried or Hungry Eyes, because he grew up literally in a railroad car turned into a house in California. And he used that. He used his own life experience to write these songs that are just as poignant today as they were when he first penned them.
He drew from his own experience. And he drew from the experience of working men and women in America. I think of a song like Working Man Blues, which is a phrase that people use to describe country music. Working man's blues or blue-collar blues. He really was in touch, much like Woody Guthrie, another. Merle's roots were in Oklahoma, although he grew up in California. Woody Guthrie the same way, and in the same way that Woody Guthrie sang about people of the soil, Merle did as well.
It's a big job just getting by with 9 kids and a wife. But I've been working, man, dang near all my life, and I'll keep on working. Long as my two hands are fit to use.
And he also was the kind of songwriter who could encapsulate in a very few words very powerful emotions. And, songs like Silver Wings came to my mind when I heard that Merle had died. You know, it's about a woman who's leaving her lover or husband, and she's on an airplane, and he's asking her not to fly away. So he had that unique capability, and it was the kind of thing that songs like his will stay with you for decades.
Just last night, I was in a bar here near the museum, and Silver Wings came on the jukebox, and we were talking about Merle and about his greatness and about the greatness of that song. He really touched emotions with very few words, but well-placed words.
He's most commonly associated with a song that, Okie from Muskogee, that didn't necessarily reflect his personal politics, but it came out at a time right in the middle of the Vietnam War when it was used almost like a patriotic ballad.
There were people who heard Okie from Muskogee as a patriotic ballad, but Merle has been very circumspect about where he stood on the political attitude expressed in the song. He has expressed sympathy for the people who bought into his point of view as it was described in the song, but he also has said he feels some distance from it. I think he has a complex relationship to songs like Okie from Muskogee or Fight Inside of Me that would suggest that he's very conservative, but his political views are much more diverse than those songs would suggest.
That is Jay Orr of the Country Music Hall of Fame. Merle Haggard died with his family and friends around him at his home in California Wednesday. During his career, Haggard recorded 38 number one country singles and wrote some of the genre's most revered classics, which have been recorded by Dolly Parton, Emmylou Harris, The Byrds, Vince Gill, The Grateful Dead, and several others.
A place where even squares can have a ball. We still wave old glory down at the courthouse. White lightning's still the biggest thrill of all. And white lightning's still the biggest thrill of all.
Thanks for joining us for VOA's International Edition. Tracy Carter directed our program. Zubair Altaib was our engineer. We welcome your input to our show. You can send us a tweet on Twitter. Our handle is @VOA_IE. You can visit us on Facebook. We are at VOA Now. And you can email us by addressing it to voaasia@voanews.com. Until next time, I'm David Byrd in Washington. Thanks for listening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Speaking at the conclusion of the recent nuclear security summit in Washington, President Barack Obama pointed to the nuclear deal agreed to by Iran, the European Union, and the P5+1 countries, the JCPOA, as one of the top accomplishments in his administration's drive to halt the spread of nuclear weapons. Regarding the JCPOA, Mr. Obama said his first priority had been to make sure that Iran's nuclear weapons program was stopped and that material that would have given Iran a very short breakout capacity was shipped out of the country. That has happened, he said. President Obama noted that so far, Iran's leaders have lived up to the JCPOA to the letter.
They have, in fact, based on the presentations that were made by the IAEA this morning to the P5+1, followed the implementation steps that were laid out. And as a consequence, sanctions related to their nuclear program have been brought down.
Mr. Obama said that Iran does face a challenge in getting businesses to feel comfortable that the JCPOA is holding and that there are no longer risks due to nuclear sanctions if companies do business with Iran. President Obama pledged to address some of the concerns Iran has expressed over this issue. But President Obama cautioned that the spirit of the JCPOA involves Iran also sending signals to the world community and businesses that it is not going to be engaging in a range of provocative actions that might scare business off.
When they launch ballistic missiles with slogans calling for the destruction of Israel, that makes businesses nervous. If Iran continues to ship missiles to Hezbollah, that gets businesses nervous.
President Obama said that the United States has a responsibility to provide clarity about the rules that govern so that the Iranian people can benefit from an improved economic situation. But, Mr. Obama stressed, Iran has to understand what every country in the world understands, which is businesses want to go where they feel safe, where they don't see massive controversy, where they can be confident that transactions are going to operate normally.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's 4 hours, universe.